Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we start our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. It's a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner. It supports your public radio stations of EEAA. You should do. You should as well at 410-319-8888. We'd like to welcome Kevin Young to our program. His new book is The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness. He's an award-winning poet, the Atticus Haygood Professor of Creative Writing and English at Emory University in Atlanta. And Kevin, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us.
Great to be here.
Amazing book, man. I would just start off by saying that I'm really going to come after you to come back on for a full hour without a pledge drive just to get back into the meat of this book.
Oh, well, thanks.
This is so much here. But let me begin with this. Because you write in the book something which we've talked about on the show here a lot, and I think it's an important concept to wrestle with and put your hands around. And it is, you write, I believe it is black culture, which is distinct, that transforms American culture, making it more black and thereby more distinct. That is a revolutionary statement in Western thought.
Well, I was really trying to talk about influence and what I saw around us. Using music was a good way to think about it. I mean, certainly the blues is the backbone of American music, and you can't have anything from jazz to even country music to hip hop without it.
But I mean, the idea though that, and we have wrestled with this on the air before, and you wrestle with in your book in so many ways throughout the book, the statement was made that, you know, that if you're in some ways, if you're American culturally, you are black.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and you know, in some ways, that's what I was trying to argue. I was also trying to describe what the subtitle says is the blackness of blackness. You know, what makes black culture, African American culture, unique. So I explore that through music and literature, but it's absolutely connected to this larger idea that you mentioned about American culture owing much to black culture.
But can't you see how, in some ways, though, I mean, of course you get, but how that is a profound thing for America to wrestle with? I mean, that idea, it's this whole...
I hope so. I mean, I think we're always wrestling with these profound ideas, and I think our founding fathers and mothers were wrestling with some of these questions as well. And one of the four mothers I talk about, for instance, is Phyllis Wheatley, the
right.
poet who... stolen and named after the slave ship that brought her, and also who wrote poetry. And she's someone who people sometimes see as kind of a figure of just assimilation, but I tried to write about, you know, some codes in her work, things she's saying in this public poetry that are private, and therefore I think just as transformative as you're talking about larger African-American culture. So, you know, there's a lot of entry points for me, and started thinking about just the spirituals and the ways we sort of understand them sometimes as this beautiful, mournful music, which it is, but also the ways in which the Negro spirituals were a coded form of escape. You know, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot was a way of guiding us out of slavery to the North, whether that's literal or sort of imaginative. So I was really interested in that black imaginary and how it transformed America, as you said.
And I mean, you also play with it in a number of ways. I mean, the first chapter was really interesting to me in your notion of the shadow book.
Yeah,
I describe that for our listeners. I mean, I just thought that I never thought about the idea of the lost texts and what's missing and what's been found again. Talk about this concept you wrote about the shadow book. It's literally, I think, very important for our culture to think about.
Yeah, I was really interested in this idea of the shadow book, a book that it used to be there but isn't. And in one way, I sort of argue that that's the book blackness writes every day. But I was interested in books that fail to be written, like Ralph Ellison's second book he never could finish.
Right.
I was also interested in books that were kind of removed which is to say, a book like Colson Whitehead's Intuitionist has a book within it, or Toy Derricotte's The Black Notebooks has a book. She constantly in the book says, you know, this it was removed from the text, which I think is just amazing to include things that were missing and suggest what else is missing. And then lastly, there's this idea of the lost shadow book, and that's the one that kind of haunts me the most.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think about, you know, the things that used to be there but weren't. You know, I'm currently editing the collected poems of Lucille Clifton, who, of course, is from Maryland. And, yeah. So her work, of course, I think suggests this in that a lot of her writing is about her mother, who had been a poet. You know, a formal poet, but a poet nonetheless, someone who wrote in her spare time, but who destroyed all her work. This, it's a haunting part of Clifton's writing. And I think she's trying to write against that shadow book in many ways, and many of us are, I think. So I was really interested in that lost idea. And I also tend to, as the book goes on, in the sort of last chapters, I end up talking about hip-hop. It goes from spirituals to hip-hop and from slavery to the present. And in the hip-hop chapter, I talk a lot about this idea of lostness, and hip-hop seems to me really in love with lostness.
In love with lostness, but you also, I'm going to ask you a question about Lucille Clifton, but I'll come back to it because she was a guest on the show many times. I knew her very well.
Yes.
She was an amazing human being.
Wonderful.
Just an amazing human being. But hip-hop, for you, in some ways, hip-hop is an amalgam of all of the African-American musical forms, the cultural forms, that's in it, through its sampling, that it brings it to a place that is very different for you.
That's right. I mean, sometimes it's quite literal in hip-hop, as you know. I mean, it takes from other music. I mean, that sampling is its backbone. And, you know, I try to argue about its sort of blues roots and things like that. But I'm also interested in the ways that, you know, people are sampling soul records as a way of borrowing its yearning, you know, because I think so much of hip hop is about wishing, or wishing even that you could wish something. You know, it's almost removed from that. It's almost like wishing to be innocent and sort of by doing that, mourning not being so. So there's this kind of tension that I think you see in other forms, whether it's the blues, which has its tension between the tragic and the comic, and thus, you know, is good time music. It's funny, often, in its despair. And then, you know, hip-hop, which kind of takes some of that away, but also has, you know, might be sampling a blues record or a rhythm and blues record, like the song Otis recently by Jay-Z and Kanye, which takes, mm-hmm. you know, sample and loops it, you know, of Otis Redding's, and I think they're really borrowing that yearning quality that Otis Redding has and making it their own. So that's what interests me very much.
We're here talking with Kevin Young. His newest book is his first, really this is your first major work of nonfiction. Most of the work you've done before is poetry.
That's right.
And there's a lot of poetry in this book. There's a lot of pieces about music in this book. About cultural history, literary history. It's an amazing amalgam. I don't know how his mind worked to put it all down on these pages, but it did. It's the Gray Album. It plays on Danger Mouse's Gray Album. We're going to come back after this break. We talk about public radio. We're going to talk about one of his theses. We're going to talk about him and come back. You don't want to miss is how the rise of modernism has to do with black culture, which people do not talk about. So we're going to get into all that and more with Kevin Young when we return. We're right now going to take a break to talk about your public radio station, WEAA, so stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're here with Kevin Young. His latest book is The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness. He's the Atticus Higgins Professor of Creative Writing and English at Emory University in Atlanta. It's good to have him with us. And so going back to where we left off, Kevin, one of the things I really found interesting here, because you Obviously, you spend a lot of your breadth of knowledge of literature, whether it is white or African American literature, is huge, and you wind it both in between one another, which in some senses to me has a lot to do with the notions of gray.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was really interested in trying to, unravel the thread of American culture, as it were. I mean, I think that linkage and that, intertwining is already there, but I wanted to kind of uncover it a bit. And I'd seen people, talk about some of these origins, but yet it still persists, this idea that, say, modernism, had no black folks in it somehow. And I was just really interested in talking about, say, Louis Armstrong's horn as modern, or the Crazy Blues by Mamie Smith as modern, and what that meant. And not just talk about the ways Picasso, say, took African masks and used them in his art, but, how Africans and African Americans on their own were modern and what that meant.
Well, I mean, one of the things you do here, and I think you do so well, which is why I think it's really important, is that you raise things that about this whole question of modernism, about how the black force in modernity in the 20th century has been left out of the conversation entirely, except for a few scholars. You take these other books to task that were written for what they've left out.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange to read a book about modernism and not see yourself or see anyone you recognize and think of as, fundamental to modernism, whether it's Langston Hughes or, the musicians I mentioned. So it was really a chance to say it again, but also perhaps say it in a slightly different way and say that, say, T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland, he quotes from African-American music in it, and Ralph Ellison writes about how when he read The Wasteland, he thought of Louis Armstrong. And I love this connection between St. Louis born, though, of course, he left for England, T.S. Eliot. And downriver, you have Satchmo playing the horn in much the same way. And that's this juxtaposition of elements, which is what Ellison says, these sort of different fragments somehow are fundamentally African-American as well. So I was really interested in that and, pulling it into, say, hip-hop, which, of course, is made up of all fragments. And what does that mean, thinking about our culture now and the ways in which it was kind of predicted by Louis Armstrong's horn?
There's a couple of quotes in here I want my people to kind of listen to and join us here, 410-319-8888. Have a conversation and make a pleasure if you like as well as we talk with Kevin Young about his book, The Gray Album, on the blackness of blackness. And let me just throw some quotes out here so we can kind of wrestle with some things you've written about. You write that the rise of modernism parallels the rise and the reach of the blues. This is no coincidence. After all, the critic Frederick Jameson identifies as the great modernist thematics of alienation, enemy, solitude, social fragmentation, isolation could be summed up as simply having them blues. I love that line.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a wordy way of saying,
well, you're a poet. You're allowed to be wordy.
Well, Jameson is wordy. I'm not. I'm trying to say that them blues is another way of saying all those things that he says, which I admire his work and what he says about modernism. But just thinking about, how can we talk about, say, the jazz age of the 20s as actually, being about African-American jazz. So that's the kind of thought I wanted to pose and question I wanted to pose to myself, but also, to us as well.
Well, how aware do you think that the what we call in America, because we segregate everything in America, but we black and white writers in the 20s and 30s, we always think of the black writers of the Harlem Renaissance, but you never tie them into anybody else who wrote great novels, whether no matter who that was, that you tried to kind of bring together and show the influence that the black world had on a lot of white writers in this period of modernism in the part of the 20th century. Talk about how you think that they themselves understood what was going on or did not.
The African-American writers?
No, the white writers.
Well, I think they, you know, it's a bit of a dance, I think. I mean, Eliot, of course.
T.S. Eliot.
Famously does it, yeah. T.S. Eliot, sorry. But I also talk about Ezra Pound, who, in his, one of his most famous poems, The Pisa and Cantos, he has all this, you know, he was in jail for being a traitor. And a lot of the language around him is African-American language of his fellow, you know, prisoners or deserters. And he, or at least the language he chose to incorporate into the cantos. So I try to talk about how, you know, this moment of his transformation in language is also, you know, he sort of becomes black, or at least that's how he depicts it. He takes on these masks, as he always had of other writers. And, you know, it really fascinates me. He even literally talks about them as sort of being on this slave ship. And what does that mean? How come I don't see people talk about that? That's what I was really interested in, and the ways in which these cultural borrowings happened, often unacknowledged. And I think sometimes there was a tension, but, you know, this kind of unacknowledgement and borrowing was happening more broadly, you know, obviously in music, all the soul music that was covered by other bands, either acknowledging it later or, you know, just making a buck. So there was this kind of tension, I think, that I was really trying to explore and hopefully got somewhere with.
I think you got somewhere with it. I mean, because when you wrote this book, talk about the music that you were listening to as you wrote this book.
Wow, you know, I was listening to everything.
I know, that's, yeah.
When I write poetry, anyway, I listen to music. Usually it's not the kind of music I might be writing about or inspired by, but I have, you know, some like 30,000 songs on my computer, you know, and I just, I wish I could say I listened to all of them, but, you know, my steady stream of material, just, I just couldn't write without it. So it felt very natural to write a book about music, but I listened to everything from the Fisk Jubilee singers who make an appearance in the book to probably my favorite blues man is Son House, though I also, of course, love blues singers like Bessie Smith and Mamie Smith, who people sometimes dismiss Mamie Smith because she was a vaudevillian, you know, but I think that's part of the thing, the conversation to have is how some of these singers came from lots of different, you know, backgrounds, including the person, Thomas A. Dorsey, who founded gospel music. He's called the father of gospel music, who wrote Take My Hand, Precious Lord, when his wife and child died. And it's such a moving song, but he had played with a lot of these blues musicians and played blues music, and that was sort of his transformation, is taking the blues and turning them into the spirituals again and turning them back into gospel. And that powerful tension is really something that I think, you know, just wakes me up in the morning and is kind of what my playlist tends toward, but also I think is the engine that's driving American culture.
It is the engine to drive American culture. And I think one of the things that you have a tendency to do with this book, at least I had a tendency to do as looking at it, is in the margins, actually writing a lot of the songs and poems to go back and get them, because you refer to so much. I mean, you know, it's because the book is built, I mean, in many ways, pragmatically and philosophically around music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of a source book, and I hope people take it for that as a way to go back in and listen. But it was also a source book for me just writing it and saying some of the things I loved, you know, and there's a simple way where it was just naming all the things I love and listing them in many ways. But I think you see that centrality or that transformation, that engine we were talking about, like in Whitney Houston's funeral. I don't know how many people saw that, but I turned it on thinking I'd watch a little bit, and, you know, a few hours later, it was amazing to see how, as people have said, you know, America got taken to church, but to see the ways, specific ways the songs worked in that service, which I don't think a lot of people see all the time, and that tradition, I think, is so important. You saw someone take the song by Sam Cooke, she's transformed it back from, it's sort of a spiritual song, anyway, and she turned it back into a spiritual. I thought that was so fascinating to see a change is going to come turned into this elegy and how that worked, you know. And that kind of transformation is always happening, I think, with African-American culture.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back here. We got to talk about your public radio station. We're going to explore some really interesting ideas and more that Kevin Young has in his book, this whole notion of lying or storying, what goes on under that, what it says about America, what it says about his view of who we are. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Kevin Young and The Gray Album. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're here with Kevin Young, joining us from Atlanta. Kevin, of course, is one of America's great poets, and his latest book is his first major work of nonfiction called The Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness. He's also the Atticus Haygood, Professor of Creative Writing and English at Emory University in Atlanta. Also the home of one of our other frequent guests, Larry Jackson. 410-319-8888. And Kevin, I suppose you know Larry.
Yeah.
A lot of good minds on that Emory.
Yeah, I've known him actually a long time. We were in school together years ago in California. So
is Emory like stealing all the great young black minds of America and bringing them there? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's right. Then we went to Atlanta. it's been nice.
It's good. So let me jump to a different part of this before we come back. The notion of the book, the whole idea of the Gray Album, and Danger Mouse's Gray Album, and how that got into your head and you created the book, that seemed clearly that in some ways pushed your soul into this book.
Yeah, in many ways, the title really helped me finish the book. I had sort of been writing something that approximated what became the book. But really, when I settled on the Gray Album as a title, it really galvanized it. And as you know, the Gray Album is this amazing mashup that DJ Danger Mouse did of the Black Album by Jay-Z. He took the vocals from that and combined them with the White Album by the Beatles and, using their music. So the background music is all, you know, this amazing kind of studio stuff the Beatles did. And
right.
Then he combined it with Jay-Z, and in a way that impulse kind of governed what I was trying to write about, and it really helped me, as you said, pour my soul in there and, you know, write the soul music chapter and write the hip-hop chapter, because the chapters kind of alternate between music and figures like Langston Hughes, who I really admire and I think also express larger things about the culture.
What does it say to you about the rhythm of a culture and society we're building in the Western world? But when you take, let's say, the Beatles White Album, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles, as the Stones, others have acknowledged that a huge part of the basis for their work is driven by American black music, soul music, and the blues, and the rest. And so you've got that, and then you've got, you know, Jay-Z coming back with the Black Album, and then the marrying of those two again. By Danger Mouse. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways he was kind of putting the twain back together, if you know what I mean. And I think that kind of... he was going back to, I guess, the source. And somehow by adding these two things together, he got to the blues. It was almost like when he was making it, it's almost like time travel or something. And I guess that's kind of the alchemy I was trying for, is how do you... combine music and literature and find out America. And that kind of combination really, it was bold that when Danger Mouse did it, I think. And I guess I just tried to be as ambitious as that in talking about all these different aspects of culture, from music to literature to even a little bit of art, but mainly just as a way of talking about all, the whole of America.
So I wonder for you, I was thinking about this, you know, this, what maybe happens after you write a book like this, and what kind of conversation you think we have to have in America. I mean, you've written a book like this, or been other books that have kind of begun to kind of try to tackle this issue of kind of the power of black culture and what it's done to America, with America, for America, in defining this country, whether it's, you know, the Signifying Monkey by Gates or Eric Lott's Love and Theft or whatever, any number of books I think of. What do you think is being generated? What kind of conversation do you think we have to begin having on the airwaves and in our universities and other places about this?
Well, I hope a larger one about, you know, the place of race in American society. I was trying to talk about sort of the pleasure of blackness and not simply, you know, the victim or some kind of aspect of blackness that sometimes gets stressed. And, you know, that kind of pleasure, I think, can be hard won. You know, that's what they have a chapter on soul music and the power of pleasure.
Yes.
And I was really interested in the ways in which soul music, like the blues, but I think even more so, you know, it's so much about pleasure. You know, it's all right to have a good time, sings Curtis Mayfield. And, you know, he's not saying that in the midst of kind of, you know, I have no problems. He's in the midst of saying we've got some problems. And I think he's not just talking to African-Americans. He's talking about Americans. It's all right to have a good time, you know. And I talk a little bit at length, I think, actually, about his covering The Carpenters, We've Only Just Begun, which I think is just one of the most amazing.
You know, I'm going to tell you something, man. When I read that in the book, I jumped on the web to listen to it again in a couple different versions, and I had to download it.
Oh, excellent. I'm glad. I mean, that's the point. You know? I mean, I think Curtis Live, I think that's one of the best live records ever.
Oh, it is, man. It is, yes.
It's just an amazing, I mean, records, period. Just an amazing record, because he takes you through all the music, and I don't just mean black music. He takes you through music, you know?
Right.
And his cover of that is so soulful and so finding the heart of the song, and then also saying, you know, we, who is this we? We've only just begun. Oh, man, to me that's just like the height of the thing, because it's talking about love at one hand, but it's also talking about us and that America that needs to have that conversation, that needs to begin, and I think that's just remarkable.
You know, staying with that theme for a minute, because one of the things you write about in the piece on soul music you write about, which I think is really profoundly important, is that it was that music that pushed something political and revolutionary, but it wasn't overt. It was like, it's what you talked about with pleasure and the pleasure of blackness being pushed as also revolution at the same time.
That's right. I mean, you know, they often are talking about love over and over again, and I'm saying that, you know, it isn't just small L love, you know, like love for one person, but also this bigger revolution, you know, a great song like Love Train, you know, people all the world get on board the Love Train. And that kind of notion, I think, is so transformative, if only on the dance floor, which, of course, is an important place. You know, this idea of the party and that we can all be under the party is sort of political, and it's a political party on one hand, but it's also just a fun time party, a party of you know, us getting along and dancing together. And I think that, you know, when people heard Dancing in the Street, they knew it was also about the unrest. But it's also a great song. You know, it can't be a kind of bad song, topical. It also has to make move and, you know, want to do the dance of the day. So I think that's really an important aspect of black culture. And, you know, I trace it back to the spirituals, which had their own codes, as we were talking about. And so there was very much this tradition of reading the codes. And so when Martha and the Vandellas or Smokey Robinson or any of them are singing, you're hearing these other things going on. And that's what makes it so rich and varied and powerful.
I mean, you name a lot of the songs, like What's Going On and all the other kind of pieces. And I think that was really an important part of this, that there's a, you know, what did Emma Goldman say? If I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution. Right.
That's right. I love that. You know.
But in terms of the power and beauty of blackness, that is, that is what, that in many ways, it is what's pushing the change.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, there's lots of music happening at the time. You know, even a song like Satisfaction by the Stones I talk about because Otis Redding has his amazing version that I think Keith Richards said that's how it sounded to him in his head. You know, Otis finally captured that. But I love his version, too, almost more because I think it really captures a kind of new original quality of it. And he's not just talking about a kind of mild dissatisfaction. He's also talking about the same stuff he's talking in the song Respect, which he wrote, but that Aretha Franklin made her own and made into this anthem of not just African-Americans demanding respect, but African-American women saying, you know, respect, you know, and you give me my propers when I come home. It's just an amazing, you know, vernacular way of saying, you know, give me my due.
So, and part of the joy here you bring to this book and you talk about is you go back home. You go back home to Louisiana. In your piece about, like, when you begin talking about lying, but not relying, but storying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so take us back home for a minute. And that, because that's a big piece of what fuels you, the poet, the writer, the thinker.
Yeah, I mean, both my parents are from Louisiana, and my whole family's from there. And, you know, one side of my family's been in the same sort of patch of land, the same parish for 200 years that we can trace. And so to me, it's about rootedness in many ways. And in terms of lying, you know, when you were down there, and if you said, you couldn't say to a grown-up,
no.
You know, you lie.
No, no.
You couldn't come close to saying that.
That's not happening.
To each other, you really couldn't. It was almost like a curse word. So you would say, you story. And I sort of take that up as a kind of way of thinking about Black culture. You story, and storying becomes a way of thinking about lots of aspects of the culture, these codes you've been mentioning. But also Louis Armstrong's solos and the way they tell a story and have a beginning, middle, and the end. And they move you and take you on this journey. And that kind of journeying, storying quality, I see at length in the culture, you know, and at work. And so I really wanted to trace that. It was another tool, as well as the music, of thinking about these linkages between things that sometimes seem far from each other, the way that Slick Rick, the rapper, tells a story. How can we relate that to something some would say is more beautiful, a Louis Armstrong solo, but I want to understand the power of both of them and connect them that way.
And I think you have. I mean, this is a book for me that belongs in probably too much for high school kids to read in the whole thing, but taking parts of it out to kind of make people wrestle with this. And I can almost see, since we didn't have time today because we're doing our fun drive, which we need to do, which I love doing, but that you almost need to hear this book with the music under it and the poems being read as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, we should have a listening party and
yeah.
And really and do it. But I also think, you know, to me, that's the pleasure, is you can go into a book and be there for a while and come back out, you know, hopefully change a little bit. That's what I love about a poem, say, or like Lucille Clifton's poems, which we talked about before, is she sends you into the poems and then back into the world, and you feel, you know, your eyes are just a little bit clearer or a little bit different. And that, you know, to me is invaluable, and that's the same thing I wanted out of this nonfiction book. I just wanted the Gray Album to give people that, almost like they're diving into a world which is part of the world, but also sends you back into the real world or our everyday world, maybe seeing things a little bit differently. So that's where I was coming from when I was setting out to write this.
And I'm really taken by the fact that you put Lucille Clifton in here, but also that you're working on a book of poetry. Are you working on her work?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, she, you know, she picked my first book of poems to be published, so I'm well aware that I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her, you know, thinking of my work. So I always pay my respect to her, and it's sort of nice to have it come full circle. You know, I actually am also a curator at Emory, and so I help get her literary papers there, and just going through those is just one of the joys of my life, and, you know, I sort of feel honored and humbled to see her writing process to see how she worked and how, in many ways, she ends up in the introduction of the book, too, because I started thinking about, you know, this idea of come celebrate with me that she has, you know, that something's tried to kill me every day and has failed. And that's a powerful sort of act of renewal, of survival. And I think that's what I hope the Gray album does, too, is try to, you know, talk about not just surviving, but, you know, thriving.
Right. And I well, you know, when you have a chance, man, you can go to our website. I'd like to hear what you think. It's steinershow.org. Hit write the name Lucille Clifton in, and we did an incredible memorial show to her with Ethelbert Miller and with a bunch of others who knew her well from Southern Maryland,
sure.
And said it was and her family. It was a wonderful hour remembering right. Lucille Clifton. So you might enjoy hearing that.
Yes.
At your leisure. So, Kevin Young, I want to say thank you so much for writing this book, and I look forward to having you back on and thinking about doing this in a different ways, maybe with some other people and some music, and just playing with this idea would be great. I want to thank you. The book is The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness. Kevin Young is the author. He's also the Atticus Haygood Professor of Creative Writing and English at Emory University in Atlanta, and one of America's great poets. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Been an honor to have you.
All right.
And we'll be right back to talk more about your public radio station, WEAA.